Good morning, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, with today's Wall Street Journal. Policy: Trump sends California troops to Portland after court blocks use of Oregon Guard. President has said the National Guard is needed to protect the city's immigration facilities. Governors object. Vitaly Arbel and Jess Bravin. The Pentagon said Sunday that about 200 members of the California National Guard who were under federal control were being reassigned to Portland, Oregon, a day after a judge's ruling blocked the Trump administration from deploying Oregon troops. A Pentagon spokesman said the troops would support U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement and other federal employees and protect federal property. Oregon Governor Tina Kotek said Sunday that she was aware that 101 federalized California National Guard members arrived in Oregon last night via plane, and it is our understanding that there are more on their way today. Kotek said her administration hadn't received official notice from the Trump administration about the deployment, which she said appeared to circumvent the federal judge's ruling. There is no need for military intervention in Oregon, said Kotek, a Democrat. There is no insurrection in Portland, no threats to national security. Kotek and other Oregon officials urged calm, saying they remain committed to allowing peaceful protests against the Trump administration. There was no insurrection in Portland, they said, and the city wasn't a war zone. President Trump had directed the Pentagon in late September to send troops to Portland to protect federal immigration facilities, saying they were under siege. The White House has said what is happening in the city is anarchy rather than protest. The president has increasingly sought to deploy the military in Democratic-run cities to fight crime or protect federal immigration enforcement operations from protesters. A federal judge on Saturday temporarily blocked the Trump administration from sending 200 members of Oregon's National Guard to Portland. The Trump administration had ordered their deployment over the state's objection, prompting the state to sue. The U.S. District Judge Karen Immergut, a 2019 Trump appointee, said there was no danger of rebellion against federal authority in Portland and that the city police could deal with incidents arising from protests against immigration enforcement. The Trump administration filed papers on Sunday to appeal that decision. A White House spokeswoman on Sunday said the president exercised his lawful authority to protect federal assets and personnel in Portland following violent riots and attacks on law enforcement. California Governor Gavin Newsom, also a Democrat, said the president was deploying 300 California National Guard personnel who were under federal control into Oregon in a breathtaking abuse of law and power. He threatened to sue to stop it. About 300 California Army National Guard soldiers remain under federal control after the Trump administration deployed state forces in June, prompting the state to sue. In June, a federal appeals court in San Francisco found that judges should be highly, if not completely, deferential to the president's determination of facts on the ground, and that the violence of some protests in Los Angeles was sufficient to justify the federalizations of California's National Guard troops to protect federal property and personnel. That decision from the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals didn't address whether federal troops were being used to enforce civilian laws, something that is generally prohibited under the 19th Century Posse Comitatus Act. In September, a federal district judge in San Francisco found that federal troops were acting unlawfully in the Los Angeles mission by undertaking functions that should be reserved for civilian police, such as traffic management and crowd control. That decision is on hold while the Trump administration appeals. At its peak, the Los Angeles deployment included 4,000 federalized California National Guard troops and 700 Marines. The Los Angeles operation has been winding down as protests subside. Immergut, in her Saturday decision, distinguished the conditions in Portland from the more volatile situation in Los Angeles in June. The Ninth Circuit's decision authorizing Trump to federalize the California National Guard didn't carry over to the Oregon force, she found, because Portland wasn't facing even the isolated outbreaks of violence in Los Angeles that the appeals panel found sufficient to justify the federal takeover of California Guard units. Exclusive: how China secretly pays Iran for oil and avoids U.S. sanctions. A hidden funding conduit has deepened economic ties between two U.S. rivals in defiance of Washington's efforts to isolate Tehran. By Lawrence Norman and James T. Aretti. U.S. sanctions made it nearly impossible to pay Iran for its oil. China has figured out how to do it anyway, in an arrangement that has largely been secret. The hidden funding conduit has deepened economic ties between the two U.S. rivals in defiance of Washington's efforts to isolate Iran. The barter-like system works like this, according to current and former officials from several Western countries, including the U.S. Iranian oil is shipped to China, Tehran's biggest customer, and in return, state-backed Chinese companies build infrastructure in Iran. Completing the loop, the officials say, are a Chinese state-owned insurer that calls itself the world's largest export credit agency, and a Chinese financial entity that is so secretive that its name couldn't be found on any public list of Chinese banks or financial firms. The arrangement, by sidestepping the international banking system, has provided a lifeline to Iran's sanctions-squeezed economy. Up to $8.4 billion in oil payments flowed through the funding conduit last year to finance Chinese work on large infrastructure projects in Iran, according to some of the officials. Iran exported $43 billion of mainly crude oil last year, according to estimates by the U.S. Energy Information Administration. Western officials estimate that around 90% of those exports go to China. China has been the predominant buyer of Iranian oil since 2018, when President Trump pulled the U.S. out of the 2015 nuclear accord and reimposed U.S. sanctions. 2 weeks after returning to office, Trump ordered the use of maximum pressure to force Tehran to curb its nuclear program and end support for allied militia groups. The directive sought to drive Iranian oil exports to zero. Since then, the U.S. has imposed sanctions on Chinese individuals and small entities, but Iranian exports to China have continued largely unabated. Beijing also provides political support for Iran. In September, Chinese leader Xi Jinping hosted Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian at a multinational summit and a military parade attended by the leaders of Russia and North Korea, a group joined in opposition to the U.S.-led world order. Western nations succeeded recently in reimposing international sanctions on Tehran that were lifted under the 2015 nuclear deal, a U.S. response to Iran's breaches of the accord. China and Russia said the move was against international law. China has also deemed Washington's Iran sanctions to be illegal. But because the sanctions threaten companies that do business with Iran with penalties that include being locked out of the international financial system, Beijing has been wary of exposing its large firms to sanctions risks. China's customs authorities haven't reported any purchases of Iranian crude since 2023. In addition to targeting Iranian exports of energy products, Washington has imposed sanctions on most Iranian banks, including its central bank, making it extremely difficult to transfer money to Iran. The hidden workaround. The system through which Iranian crude is exchanged for Chinese built infrastructure involves two primary players: China's large state insurance company, Sinosure, and a China-based financing mechanism that the officials all referred to as Chuxin. The officials pieced together their understanding of the system through financial documents, intelligence assessments, and diplomatic channels. In the arrangement, some of the officials said, an Iranian-controlled company registers the sale of oil to a Chinese buyer controlled by state-owned oil trader Zhonghai Zhurong, a U.S. sanctions target. the Chinese buyer, in return, deposits hundreds of millions of dollars each month with Chuxin, officials said. Chuxin then delivers the funds to Chinese contractors that perform engineering work in Iran, in project whose funding is insured by Sinosure. Sinosure serves as the financial glue that holds the projects together. Chuxin isn't named among the nearly 4,300 banking firms registered by China's top industry regulators, and couldn't be found on publicly available official lists of financial firms and company registries. The Iranian crude that reaches China takes an indirect route to mask its origins, involving ship-to-ship transfers and often mixing in oil from other nations, the U.S. government and industry experts say. Beijing's underwriter, Sinosure, formerly China Export and Credit Insurance, is a financial tool of China's central government that supports Beijing's international development priorities, a mandate with particular significance in a politically sensitive location, such as Iran. Sinosure has supported over $9 trillion in trade and investment activities around the world as of the end of last year, according to the company. In Iran, Chinese infrastructure projects tend to be huge state-directed endeavors, including airports, refineries, and transport projects managed by China's largest state-backed banks and engineering groups. China made over $25 billion in financial commitments to build infrastructure in Iran between 2000 and 2023, according to Aid Data, a research lab at William & Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia. Sinosure had a direct role in 16 of the 54 documented deals. The U.S., which has used targeted sanctions against Chinese firms, hasn't blacklisted companies for doing civilian work in Iran, nor has it targeted a large Chinese bank. No documentation in the public domain could be found directly linking Sinosure with the oil for construction arrangement in Iran. In response to questions, China's foreign ministry said that it is unaware of the arrangement, opposes illegal unilateral sanctions, and that international law allows for normal cooperation between nations. Zhuhai Zerong and Sinosure didn't respond to requests for comment about the arrangement. Officials at the Iranian mission to the United Nations didn't comment on the payment mechanism or on China's oil purchases. China's framework for doing infrastructure work in Iran likely mirrors a documented Sinosure agreement in Iraq, and Aid Data executive director Brad Parks. Under the 20-year-old deal, Sinosure backstops Chinese lending for Chinese projects in exchange for oil. Every creditor and every construction contractor has to come under this umbrella, said Parks. Chinese infrastructure work in Iran has increased since 2021, 25-year partnership deal. The projects are critical for Iran, which has struggled to maintain basic services such as water and electricity. Iran is also able to recover some of its oil sales revenue by buying goods directly in China. It also manages to bring some of its revenue back to its region to use, U.S. officials say. Iranian entities rely on shadow banking networks to evade sanctions and move millions. John K. Hurley, Undersecretary of the Treasury for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence, said last month, announcing sanctions on people and entities in the United Arab Emirates and Hong Kong for allegedly coordinating the transfer of funds. Neither Sinosure nor Chuxin has been hit with U.S. sanctions. The Treasury Department declined to comment on the description of the activities of the Chinese entities. U.S. Behind Chicago's tense week, protester clashes and tactical gear downtown. Illinois' Democrats say the federal show of force is meant to intimidate and instill fear, by Joe Barrett. President Trump's mobilization of Illinois National Guard troops Saturday kept a tense week in Chicagoland. Federal agents made arrests in tourist areas, they conducted a massive nighttime raid on a South Side apartment building, and they skirmished with protesters outside a migrant processing facility and on city streets. Illinois Democrats say the show of force is meant to intimidate and instill fear. Illinois is not a photo opportunity or a war zone. It's a sovereign state where our people deserve rights, respect, and answers, said Governor J.B. Pritzker, a Democrat, in a social media post. The White House maintains the efforts are necessary to make the city safer. Trump has been increasingly using the military on U.S. soil to either participate in what he has called a crime crackdown or protect immigration buildings and agents from Americans protesting his immigration policies. The Illinois governor, who has repeatedly touted falling violent crime rates in the city in recent years, says sending the guard without being asked is unconstitutional. The Trump administration has also been sparring with Democratic governors over sending troops to Portland, Oregon. On Saturday, a federal judge temporarily blocked Trump from deploying Oregon National Guard members, finding that he overstepped his authority in seeking to take command of troops from the state. Then on Sunday, California Governor Gavin Newsom said the federal government was sending to Oregon 300 California National Guard troops that it had already taken control of earlier this year in response to Los Angeles protests. Why are all ICE agents so short? The Immigration Custom and Enforcement Facility in the western suburbs of Broadview has become a local epicenter of protests against the White House immigration policy. Protesters chant and shout at ICE officials, and some have tried to stop vehicles from getting in and out of the facility in the village of 7,800. On a recent night, a woman with a bullhorn roasted officials through a fence as they walked past. "There are no hot ICE agents," she said. "Why are all ICE agents so short?" Demonstrators have accused ICE agents of unprovoked violence toward them, saying that agents have repeatedly deployed tear gas and pepper balls during peaceful protests. Broadview Mayor Katrina Thompson said Tuesday the police were investigating three alleged attacks, including one on a news person by federal agents. "We've seen this pattern before through history. You're just trying to create this fear and intimidation," Thompson said in an interview. "We have to take a stand." Daniel Schaus, a 37-year-old delivery driver, said he was a victim in two of the incidents being investigated by Broadview police, both of which involved ICE officers striking him with vehicles after he had left the front lines of a protest. He said his voice is so loud he doesn't need to use a bullhorn. "I think that's why they've been targeting me, because I've been very, very vocal with them," he said. Tricia McLaughlin, Homeland Security Assistant Secretary, said the federal agents were the ones dealing with unprovoked violence. She said the city was pursuing bogus criminal investigations to smear our brave ICE enforcement officers, who are facing a more than 1,000% increase in assaults, including sniper attacks, cars being used as weapons, and assaults from rioters. She denied that any members of the media had been targeted by ICE agents, saying that one pepper ball was fired at the wheel well of a Ford Bronco that failed to follow orders to turn around, and the driver didn't identify herself as media. Federal prosecutors charged five individuals outside of Broadview last weekend with assaulting federal agents, two of whom they said had loaded firearms. Starting Thursday, state police and local law enforcement said they would take a more active role in crowd control under a new unified command. They have created free speech zones far away from the fence line on one side of the ICE facility, but clashes have increasingly moved to the other side. Reverend Michael Wolf, senior minister of Lake Street Church of Evanston, said Friday morning he and other demonstrators in Broadview were ordered to move after standing on a curb protesting for hours. "State police officers pushed him and others back roughly with their batons," he said. "Then an ICE officer grabbed him by the neck and violently twisted his nipple. There's no polite way to say that," he said. "If they're willing to do that to a pastor, what do you think they're doing to people in detention?" said Reverend Wolf, 35, who was wearing his clerical collar. "I hope he rethinks his choices." DHS didn't respond to a request for comment. Tactical gear downtown. federal agents launched highly visible operations elsewhere in Chicago. Last weekend, dozens of Border Patrol officers in full tactical gear took to downtown sidewalks seeking to make arrests. They drew jeers from a crowd and sparked a viral video of a man on a bike who taunted the agents and narrowly escaped when they gave chase. Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson called the show of force a stunt and a disgrace. "They are making arrests based on how you look," Governor Pritzker said. "They're not targeting violent gang members. They're arresting tamale vendors and deliverymen." On Saturday, McLaughlin of DHS said the federal vehicles doing a routine patrol in Chicago were rammed and trapped by about 10 vehicles. "Agents fired on a woman in one of the cars who was carrying a semi-automatic weapon," she said. "The woman took herself to the hospital and no federal officers were seriously injured," McLaughlin said. Homeland Security said to the woman, Marimar Martinez had a long history of doxing federal agents. In a federal criminal complaint filed Sunday, Martinez and a male suspect were charged with assaulting, resisting, and intimidating an officer of the U.S. The complaint said a Border Patrol agent fired about 5 shots at Martinez's vehicle as it drove toward him. The document makes no mention of whether she had a weapon other than her vehicle. An activist group said the federal agents had crashed into the civilian vehicle, resulting in a multi-car accident. Southside Blackhawks. Early Tuesday morning, hundreds of federal agents from the FBI, Border Patrol, and Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives launched a raid backed by Black Hawk helicopters on an apartment complex on the city's south side. Homeland Security officials say the Tren de Aragua Venezuelan gang had been operating in the building and that they apprehended 37 people living in the country illegally. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem, who was in the area on Friday, shared a movie trailer-like video of the raid of the building on social media with the message, "Chicago, we're here for you." Neighbors described a chaotic scene with helicopters buzzing around, shining searchlights into windows and cars, and agents in tactical gear surrounding the building. Agents broke down doors and hauled out nearly every resident in zip ties, including crying children, neighbors, and public officials. Later in the week, the large building appeared all but abandoned, with a stack of mattresses and other furniture piled up in the back and outside doors hanging open. "It's pretty frightening to see that happen in a city out of nowhere, and the fact that it just literally happened that quickly should be frightening to everybody in the country," said Alderman Andre Vasquez, chairman of the Chicago City's Council Committee on Immigrant and Refugee Rights. Middle East. Gazans have a message from Hamas. "End the war now. Weary Palestinians say President Trump's peace plan isn't perfect, but a halt to the fighting is more important." By Abir Ayyub. Alaa Khalil, a 49-year-old Palestinian living in a tent camp in Gaza, doesn't like the terms of President Trump's peace plan, but she likes the war even less. A mother of 6 who had to flee her home in Gaza City because of the fighting, Khalil said she is upset Trump's plan has no timetable for an Israeli withdrawal from the enclave and no guarantee that Israel's campaign against the militant group will stop for good. "In many aspects, this is not in the Palestinians' favor," she said in an interview. Even so, she said she hopes Hamas accepts it so the bloodshed stops. "It is hazardous to generalize about public sentiment in Gaza. There are no reliable opinion surveys. But half a dozen people in the Palestinian enclave, reached by the Wall Street Journal, all had a consistent message. Hamas should accept the U.S. brokered deal, despite what they see as its shortcomings." War has turned much of Gaza into ruins, driven the bulk of its 2 million people from their homes, and left more than 67,000 dead, according to Palestinian health authorities, who don't say how many were combatants. For Khalil, that view marks a shift. She said she supported Hamas before the war. Her husband worked in the Hamas government's finance ministry. He was detained by Israel when the conflict started, but Hamas's conduct during the war has led her to question the group's decision-making and leadership. Hamas triggered the conflict with its October 7, 2023 attacks on Israel that left about 1,200 people dead. The group also kidnapped roughly 250 hostages. She says Hamas's assault lacked a clear objective, and she blames the group for failing to secure Gaza and stockpile food and medicine. Now displaced for a second time with her husband still detained, she is upset that Hamas is making an issue of disarmament when its weapons have been shown throughout the war to be ineffective at stopping the Israeli advance. "I don't feel like our suffering matters to them," Khalil said. "I'm very upset with their statements." Under Trump's 20-point plan announced Monday last week, Hamas is to release the 48 living and dead hostages it holds, as well as its weapons. Administration of Gaza would be handed to an apolitical committee of technocrats, as an Arab-led international force would guarantee security. Talks on the first objectives of the deal, the release of the hostages in exchange for hundreds of Palestinian prisoners, get underway this week in Egypt. Israel and Hamas have said they are on board, but each has expressed caveats or qualifiers that signal an agreement could be hard to reach. Hamas objects to turning over its small arms, which it considers defensive weapons, and wants a more detailed timeline for Israel's staged withdrawal. Israel said it agrees to the deal, but on its terms, which requires a capitulation by Hamas. Aman Bada, the mother of the days-old premature baby, said she wants Hamas to relent. "For me, anything that ends the war is good," she said. "I don't care about Hamas's weapons, its leaders, the fate of their prisoners. My husband, my son, and I, we are the ones paying the price." Bada, 31, says she gave birth 4 days after heavy shelling drove her family from their home in Gaza City. Her son is now in intensive care in Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in the central Gaza town of Deir al-Balah. She lives nearby in a bombed-out building with her extended family. The bathroom, she said, is a tent in the street with rats and insects. She said she wonders what Hamas thought it would happen when it launched the 2023 attacks, why it didn't prepare, and what it thinks it could have gained from further fighting. She doesn't trust Israel, and Trump's deal isn't perfect, but she said it does promise the things she needs. A ceasefire, food, reconstruction. "What are we waiting for?" she said. "At the end of the day, we are suffering." Even when Gazans are out of the line of fire, living conditions are a constant struggle. Razin Hawali, 29, displaced from Gaza City and now in Deir al-Balah, lives in a tent on land her family has to rent. Hawali says life amid the war is hard. "Very few people she knows oppose Trump's plan," she said. "Everyone wants at least to be able to pitch a tent in front of their old homes." "Disarming Hamas is the last thing on my mind," she said. "I want this war to stop at any cost." Reem Salah, 40, fled Gaza City a week ago as fighting there intensified, and is now living with her 7 children, including 2 young twins, in the southern town of Khan Yunis. They fled on foot, a 14-hour walk, and couldn't bring their belongings, so her husband stayed behind. "Before the war, their life was good," she said. Her husband worked in Israel, and they had money to buy what they needed. She has since sold off her gold bit by bit to get by. The last of it went before they evacuated to the south. "Conditions now are terrible," she said. She worries about the years her children have spent out of school and that they have been learning war terminology. "I know there are many unfair demands, but all I want is an end to the war, rebuilding, and for my kids to go back to school," she said. "All we want is safety." Russia. Trump praises Putin's offer to extend nuclear treaty. Accord capping number of long-range nuclear weapons was due to expire in February, but would be extended by a year, by Michael R. Gordon. President Trump on Sunday praised a Kremlin proposal to continue the limits on long-range nuclear weapons for one more year, which would preserve a main element of the last major arms control agreement between the U.S. and Russia. This is the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. "Sounds like a good idea to me," Trump said Sunday when asked about the Russian offer. Russian President Vladimir Putin said last month that he was prepared to adhere to the caps in the New START agreement for an additional year after the accord expires in February. Proponents of the deal say that keeping the weapon ceilings in place will provide a measure of stability when there are sharp tensions between Moscow and the West over Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and provide time for the U.S. and Russia to negotiate a follow-on accord. Critics say that keeping the New START treaty, which covers U.S. and Russian strategic forces, will preclude the U.S. from expanding its arsenals to respond to China's growing nuclear capabilities. The questions over how to limit long-range nuclear weapons has become all the more important as the arms control framework that has regulated the military competition between Washington and Moscow has crumbled over the past decade. The U.S. withdrew from the treaty with Russia, banning intermediate-range American and Russian missiles based on land in 2019 after accusing Moscow of developing an illegal ground-launched cruise missile. Lesser arms control agreements have also gone by the wayside. President Joe Biden extended the New START treaty for 5 years in one of his first major foreign policy actions, but the treaty was buffeted by tensions over Russia's invasion of Ukraine. In 2023, the U.S. accused the Russians of violating the New START agreement by denying on-site inspections, impeding strict monitoring of the treaty. Putin responded by suspending Russia's participation in the treaty. Even so, the two sides were careful not to abandon the caps in nuclear forces, which limits each side to no more than 1,550 deployed nuclear warheads. It also sets a limit of 700 on the land-based ballistic missiles, submarine-launched missiles, and strategic bombers that carry them. In his comments Sunday, Trump didn't say if the U.S. was coupling its acceptance of the Russian idea with proposal of its own or whether it had formally responded to the Kremlin offer. The White House didn't immediately respond to a request for comment. The New START treaty entered into force in 2011 and can't be formally extended a second time, but nothing prevents the two sides from opting to observe its weapon ceiling after it expires. The idea of prolonging the treaty has drawn criticism from some nuclear arms experts who say the New START treaty is out of date because it doesn't apply to Russia's shorter-range tactical nuclear weapons or cover China's growing nuclear arsenal. China, not Russia, is America's foremost geopolitical rival, and Beijing is engaging in the most rapid nuclear weapons expansion since the 1960s, said Matthew Kroening of the Atlantic Council, who was a national security advisor to the 2012 Mitt Romney and 2016 Marco Rubio presidential campaigns. Bilateral arms control deals with Moscow alone won't cut it. It is not the 1970s anymore. But other arms control proponents said extending the New START ceilings would buy time for talks on a follow-on deal. Now the Kremlin and the White House need to formalize the arrangement and immediately direct their teams to begin negotiations on a new, more comprehensive agreement or agreements that address difficult issues with which the two sides have long struggled, said Daryl Kimball, the executive director of the Arms Control Association. Putin's willingness to adhere to the New START limits for another year doesn't mean that negotiating a follow-on would be easy. In his comments last month, Putin also criticized the possible development of U.S. space-based anti-missile defenses as a destabilizing action. Trump is mounting a major program to develop space-based and other anti-missile defenses, which he has dubbed Golden Dome. What's in your go bag? How Taiwan packs for disaster. Crisis prep gets personal on an island facing threats from extreme weather to military invasion. By Joyu Wang. The people of Taiwan carry out their lives under the threat of typhoons, earthquakes, tsunamis, and military invasion. So this June, when a Facebook post to the U.S. officials by U.S. officials urged the Taiwan public to pack your go bag and be ready for anything, the theme went viral. Online sales of evacuation kits multiplied, stores set up displays of survival gear, and influencers dropped videos showing what to include. But Taiwanese leaders have struggled to persuade the public to prepare for the worst. The government last month issued a newly updated crisis response handbook featuring a go bag packing list with extra checkboxes for the elderly, babies, and pets. Not everyone in Taiwan is disaster ready. The Wall Street Journal visited some who have made crisis prep a way of life and quizzed them about what they have packed and why. Yuki Wang, Qian Huang Wang, and Wendy Shia. For Yuki Wang and her children, survival prep is educational. Her family participates in a rural homeschooling group where outdoor expeditions are part of the curriculum. A civil defense course 2 years ago helped Wang connect the dots between planning for a trek and preparing for an emergency evacuation. Her must-haves: an emergency blanket to keep warm and a life straw which filters water as you drink. Wang, 38, has discussed with her children how to handle various emergencies, including what to do if they run out of food and water in the mountains and where to take cover during an earthquake. Her youngest son, 4, Kian, is too small to carry much but insists on toting his best friend, a stuffed toy duck, Yaya. "I want to hug it when I sleep," Kian says. Ting Ho Lai became a prepper this spring, she said, when one of her two cats was diagnosed with diabetes. If China and Taiwan go to war, she found herself thinking, the cats, both 11 years old, could be left alone, suffer and die. Her vet's advice: to protect your cats, you have to make sure you stay alive first. Lai began studying disaster response guidelines from around the world and organized discussion groups on how to prepare for a conflict with China. She also stocked up on bottled water, canned food, and pet supplies. Lai, a 32-year-old fashion consultant, carries an everyday bag that she said is both practical and suits her personal style. She said it is important to integrate disaster preparations into her daily life without turning herself into a hardcore military type. She also tries not to buy Chinese products. "Every time I buy something made in China, I think my money is going to help them make another bullet to use on us," she said. Lai is planning with the year 2027 in mind after reading that U.S. officials said Chinese leader Xi Jinping wants his armed forces to be ready by that year to seize Taiwan. "Preparing for a potential invasion has been mentally exhausting. This is a long fight," she said. As for the pets, Lai has come to recognize that cats don't have to be taught survival skills. Although she won't be able to provide medication if she is gone, she has prepared her home for hideaways for her cats and a screen door that they can open themselves if they need to escape. Yan Chen Chi began preparing for disasters more than 25 years ago, after living through one of Taiwan's worst, the 1999 earthquake that killed more than 2,400 people. She still panics every time her building shakes. "My back goes numb and I rush out of my room," said Yan, who is 60, pointing to the spot by an interior wall beneath a cross where she takes cover. But it would take a fire or a missile strike to get her to flee the 600-square-foot apartment she shares with her mother. Instead, Yen keeps enough supplies to stay put for 2 months. Water bottles are stacked in the kitchen and tucked under her mother's bed. Closets are packed with canned and shelf-stable food, some marked to last until 2054. She has radios with backup phones, power banks, generators, and solar panels. Her apartment is equipped with radiation detectors, air quality monitors, and emergency lights. Yen keeps a spreadsheet to track expiration dates, expenses, stockpiled calories, and where everything is. After Russia invaded Ukraine in 2022, she feared that a Chinese invasion of Taiwan would follow. "How could I not be nervous?" Yan said. Yan carries an everyday bag with for a few supplies for what she considers worst-case scenario, such as a terrorist attack at a train station. It includes protective gloves, goggles, and masks, a tourniquet, and medicine. While Yan believes in most cases that she and her mother would be safest at home, she does keep a well-stocked go bag. But her mother, Wu Meihua, is 90, suffers from kidney disease, and needs assistance to get around. "I would never just grab a bag and run out," Yan said. "There's no way I could run while carrying my mother." Kyle Hu. "Nobody likes war and no one wants it to happen, but we still have to be ready," said Kyle Hu. The former sergeant in Taiwan's Special Forces started a civil defense training business in 2022, shortly after the war in Ukraine began. A 33-year-old father of two, Hu provided a small arms training and teaches tactical first aid and other survival skills. Hu keeps camouflage clothing in his kit, but warns that dressing like a soldier could draw unwanted attention. "This stuff," he said, "you only wear it when it's really necessary to keep yourself hidden and stay safe." He also keeps a gas mask, helmet, and body armor on hand, he said, just in case. He avoids Chinese-made products. "When I'm in a high-risk situation, I need gear I can trust 100%, he said. Hu also said that Taiwan is far from prepared for a Chinese invasion. "It will never be enough," he said. "I just hope no one thinks the chance is zero. Even if it's just 1%, we still need to be ready." Cheng Hsin and Li Chengho. Cheng Hsin, another homeschooler, said teaching her 7-year-old son to pack for a long hike helped prepare him for an emergency evacuation. "I feel it works for both purposes," said Cheng, "because in the mountains, there's no water, no electricity, and no food." Her son, Li Chenho, stocked up for a recent trek with a sleeping bag, a change of clothes, a water bottle, and instant rice. He also packed 6 braised eggs, a favorite snack that he calls his trail rations. World. Ukraine's new strategy for keeping the lights on through a winter of war. Top secret sites house rows of batteries designed to support power grid during bombardments. By Jane Lutomoenko. Ukraine's power grid has weathered 3 winters of Russian bombardment, during which engineers patched up substations under missiles and drone fire, and civilians spent days in the cold and dark as Moscow attempted to sap their resolve. Now, heading into their 4th winter of war, the country's energy suppliers are banking on a network of massive U.S.-designed batteries held at top-secret locations to help keep the lights on. At one such outdoor site this fall, rows of 8-foot-high white battery blocks emitted a constant high-pitched hum. "The best sound in the world, because it means they're working," said Vadim Ukin, an advisor on energy storage to DTEC, Ukraine's largest private energy supplier, which spearheaded the project. The battery parks, with a combined total capacity of 200 megawatts, can supply around 2 hours of energy for roughly 600,000 homes, equivalent to powering a city about the size of Washington, D.C. Most crucially, under bombardment, the power cells buy engineers time to restore service and prevent a blackout. The battery parks are designed to help plug holes and regulate Ukraine's energy supply, offering an alternative source of power even when the grid comes under attack. The $140 million battery program, completed in August, is crucial for Ukraine, which has raced to modernize and decentralize its electricity grid, in part to help it withstand Russian barrages. To avoid making the batteries a target, Ukrainians are tight-lipped about their specific location and details of the measures in place to protect them from Russian attack, which includes strategically placed air defenses. The 6 sites across Kyiv and the Dnipropetrovsk region connect to the power grid and deliver power if another source, such as thermal power plants, goes offline, helping to avoid the rolling blackouts the Ukrainians have experienced for years. We have lost more than half of our generating capacity due to destruction by rockets, Shahids, and Sohan, said Ola Boshlovets, Ukraine's former energy minister, referring to the type of attack drone favored by the Kremlin. Since the beginning of Russia's full-scale invasion, all of Ukraine's thermal power plants have come under attack. Although some power stations are back online, others are beyond repair. Before the war, Ukraine obtained most of its energy from its nuclear power facilities, which Russia has since targeted. Ukraine's largest nuclear power plant is no longer providing the country with energy after being occupied by Moscow's forces at the start of the conflict. Nuclear power now makes up about half of Ukraine's energy mix. Russia's campaign against Ukraine's energy infrastructure is designed to punish civilians by depriving them of heat and electricity over the cold winter months, in the hope that Kyiv will bend to Moscow's will. The strategy, which has seen Moscow bomb substations, coal mines, and gas sites, hasn't worked so far. Last winter, energy workers largely maintained the power supply, even as missiles and drones rained down on them. But since then, Russia has ramped up its production of attack drones, allowing it to overwhelm Ukraine's air defenses by sending hundreds of the unmanned aerial vehicles in a single attack, an approach likely to make this winter even more perilous for Ukraine. In U.S.-brokered peace talks earlier this year, Russian and Ukrainian negotiators discussed a ceasefire on each other's energy infrastructure. Over the following months, attack on power plants lessened, but as the winter approached, both sides are increasing such assaults. Ukraine has taken out at least 15% of Russia's oil refining capacity in response to the targeting of its energy sites, and 77,000 people were without power after an attack in Russia's Belgorod region last week, according to Russian state media. If we don't have an agreement, some kinds of ceasefire, talks, and so on, then these attacks with the coming cold will be more targeted, more practical, and of course they will bring nothing good, Boshlovets, a former energy minister, said of strikes by Russia. To combat serial assaults, Ukraine has persistently asked for more air defense capabilities from its allies in the West and has particularly sought the Patriot, the American-made system capable of intercepting ballistic missiles. President Trump has promised the delivery of more systems, and Ukraine is set to receive two additional systems from Germany by the end of the year, but says it needs more to fully protect its cities and infrastructure. Building out alternative sources of energy, such as wind and solar, has also been a matter of defense for Ukraine. Renewables won't fully replace nuclear or coal, but their presence injects diversity into the energy mix. They also operate independently, which is an asset in war zones, where if one wind turbine is hit, the rest can keep turning, compared with a thermal power station that comes to a complete halt if it is struck. Batteries are now playing their part in renewables too, helping regulate energy generated from all sorts of sources to make sure that electricity flows even when the sun doesn't shine or when turbines stand still. There's always fluctuations, there's always mess in the system, and somebody needs to clear this mess, said Utkin of DTEC. These machines usually clear the mess very, very effectively. Much of what makes batteries an attractive option for Ukraine is their modularity. Each block can be taken offline and replaced with no impact to other cells. Were one of them hit, Utkin said, it wouldn't be the end of the world. I would be crying and just cursing, but honestly, to replace one cube is not so difficult, he said. Although the new network is the largest series of battery parks in Ukraine, it isn't the first. In 2021, Utkin oversaw the construction of another such park in Enderhodar, a city in Ukraine's Zaporizhzhia region that Russia occupied the following year. A few hours before Russian forces entered the region, I can wipe the software for the batteries, turning them into expensive bricks that are now essentially useless. Minimal equipment is required to replace each cell in the new network, and all of them have fire safety features that, in the context of Ukraine, become more important, said Julian Nebreda, the CEO of Fluence, the American company that supplied the batteries. Despite Russia's bombardment of the electricity grid and the risk to the batteries themselves, Nebreda said his company didn't hesitate to sign up to be part of the project, which is financed by DTEC and loans from a consortium of Ukrainian banks. Everybody understood the importance of getting this done, he added. Policy. High stakes for Trump in Supreme Court's new term. Justices are staring down big questions about presidential power, elections, and transgender athletes in women's sports. By Brent Kendall. The Supreme Court officially returns for a new term Monday, after a summer break that wasn't much of a reprieve. Though the justices haven't taken the bench since June, they have refereed a flood of emergency disputes involving the Trump administration that have produced constant headlines and sparked internal dissent. Now back in earnest, they will hear 7 months worth of cases, including one that could shape the Trump presidency, U.S. elections, and transgender rights. Here's what to know about the docket. Trump's aggressive claims of presidential power to be tested. While President Trump has rushed to the court nearly 30 times since returning to office, the justices have yet to issue a full ruling on the legality of any of his efforts. That will change soon. The court on November 5th will review his sweeping global tariffs in a case with the highest of stakes for the business world and for the president's powers to unilaterally regulate the economy if he deems that a national emergency calls for him to do so. Lower courts have ruled the president acted illegally in imposing the tariffs, which are typically the domain of Congress. Still, the outcome of the high court is far from clear. Another blockbuster case about the president's power to fire top people at independent government agencies is less in doubt. Trump has dismissed an array of these officials, spurning a 90-year-old court decision that said the president can only fire them for specific reasons, such as malfeasance or neglect of duties. The high court has allowed Trump's dismissals, for now, a strong signal that they are preparing to throw out those limits on presidential authority. The one wrinkle is the Federal Reserve. The court has suggested that the Fed, unlike other agencies, is uniquely protected from political interference. The justices in January will consider Trump's bid to remove Fed Governor Lisa Cook. A big year for Chief Justice John Roberts. How the Chief Justice leads the institution in navigating Trump's testing of legal norms is sure to be a big part of his legacy, and this term will likely set the tone for the years to come. The court finds itself in a difficult environment. It faces low public approval ratings and the perceptions from Democrats that its conservative supermajority is treating Trump with kid gloves. Trump's supporters, meanwhile, have been quick to criticize the court when it hasn't come to his aid, and the president himself has repeatedly attacked lower court judges who ruled against him, a sign of what could be ahead if the Supreme Court does the same. While those may not be the most pressing concerns for Roberts, he is eager to safeguard the institution's integrity and keep it out of the political fray as much as possible. More hot-button issues. The court again finds itself in the middle of some of the nation's most divisive issues. In a pair of cases from Idaho and West Virginia, it will consider whether states can ban transgender athletes from girls' and women's sports teams. The cases examine whether such bans unlawfully discriminate on the basis of sex and transgender status. Last term, the court ruled states could ban transgender health treatments for minors. This week, it will consider a case involving mental health care, where the political dynamics are flipped. Some blue states want to ban conversion therapy that aims to change a patient's sexual orientation or gender identity, saying it is harmful and doesn't work. Conservative therapists argue that they have a First Amendment right to counsel as they wish. The court is also returning to the issue of gun rights, announcing Friday that it would consider a case from Hawaii to decide whether states can prohibit licensed gun owners from carrying firearms on private property that is open to the public unless the property owner agrees. Voting and campaign finance. Ahead of the 2026 midterm elections, the court is considering cases that could affect the rights of voters and fundraising rules for candidates. The law is hearing arguments for a second time over redistricting in Louisiana, in a case that examines the continuing ability of states to draw political districts that give minorities the opportunity to elect their candidates of choice. The case could have broader ramifications for Voting Rights Act protections enacted to remedy discriminatory voting practices. Early next year, the court will take up a potentially blockbuster campaign finance case that re-examines congressional rules limiting how much political parties can spend on campaign advertising that is coordinated directly with the candidates they support. Republicans are mounting a free speech challenge to the restrictions. Emergency docket keeps growing. With lower courts fielding hundreds of Trump-related lawsuits, preliminary decisions in those cases are likely to fuel more emergency appeals to the Supreme Court. In these cases, the justices aren't issuing final rulings, but instead are deciding whether Trump's initiatives can go into effect while litigation continues. These appeals add significantly to the court's workload and require it to continue thorny legal issues on compressed time frames with minimal legal briefing. The Trump administration already has fired 28 emergency appeals over the last 8 months. The court on Friday allowed the White House to lift temporary legal protections for Venezuelans living in the U.S. It is still considering whether the administration can prohibit transgender and non-binary people from picking their preferred sex on their passports. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Cicely Tiernan, your volunteer broadcaster on SunSounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programming on SunSounds.